Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at the time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in moments, Ryan Grimm will tell the story of the CIA drugs and Gary Webb. And then, just after the bottom of the hour, Jake Blumgart visits a little Detroit at the edge of Philadelphia. First, though, a little self-promotion. I have a cover story in this month's Harper's on Hillary Rodham Clinton, which the editors gave the tabloidish headline, "Stop Hillary!" Exclamation point. And I do mean tabloidish. It caught the attention of a New York Post reporter who wrote it up for the paper's Page 6 gossip column. In the piece, I review Hillary's life in a very non-friendly way, in hope of derailing her unannounced yet all but certain presidential campaign. My major objections to Hillary, which is how she seems to brand herself these days, fall into three categories: the dynastic, the personal, and the political. First, after two Bushes, do we really need another Clinton? Second, the personal. Hillary has a long record of dishonesty, ranging from making up stories about the origin of her name. She said she was named after Sir Edmund Hillary, but he didn't climb Mount Everest until several years after she was born, to lies about all the various Arkansas scandals she brought with her to Washington. Par for the politician course, I suppose, but her supporters like to think of her as several cuts above the ordinary, a judgment I'm sure she concurs with. But the most important objection is political. The last thing we need is another hawkish, Wall Street-friendly Democrat in the White House. Many people, including me when I started researching the piece, don't appreciate how deeply involved Hillary was with creating the new Democrat paradigm, tough and business-friendly, replacing the old softy New Deal Great Society model. While governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton took a number of swipes at unions in the state as part of a campaign to shred the long-lasting Democratic alliance with labor. He, with Hillary closely involved, launched an attack on the teachers' union in Arkansas, a campaign with ugly racial undertones that was a model for later edu reform efforts. Though she once served on the board of the Children's Defense Fund, Hillary supported Bill's effort to end welfare, which is responsible for keeping millions of people, mostly women and children, in poverty now, though of course she likes to present herself as an advocate for women and children. That advocacy mainly takes the form of photo ops in symbolic programs. It's very reminiscent of her husband's approach. I remember back in the 1990s taking apart his budget proposals. The prose sections always contained high-flying rhetoric about investing in people and building that bridge to the 21st century. But when you looked at the actual numbers, you had to take them out to two or three decimal places to notice any change. That's the essence of the new Democrat paradigm. But it isn't new anymore. It's more than 20 years old. It represented the consolidation of Reaganism, the conversion of what is supposed to be the Popular Party into a near-pure instrument of neoliberalism. To a neoliberal, the solution to a social problem should always involve a market, and if the market doesn't exist, it must be created ex nihilo. This is the logic of Obamacare. The whole approach has lost even its novelty value now. It's not adequate to deal with climate change, polarization, and structural economic stagnation, problems that are caused by an excess of markets, not a deficiency. The marketization of everything has led to severe social fragmentation and the erosions of all notion of solidarity. Hillary sometimes evokes those notions of solidarity, but usually in photo ops with women from poor countries, in her colorful native garb, where she uplifts them by her mere presence. As for policies that might change their actual material and social status, well, they're rather thin in the ground because they might spoil the investment climate. Anyway, I urge you to check out the piece in the current Harper's. It's not on the web, alas, but it's a great magazine. Okay, now on to Ryan Grimm. Grimm is the Washington bureau chief of the Huffington Post. His 2009 book, This Is Your Country on Drugs, A History of Americans' Long and Complicated Relationship with Intoxicants, has quite a bit about Gary Webb, the author of a series of articles in the San Jose Mercury News in 1996 on the CIA's role in bringing crack to L.A. For his work, Webb was hounded by his profession, with both the L.A. Times and Washington Post devoting enormous resources to discrediting his work, even though Webb was essentially correct. He ended up ruined and killed himself in 2004. The release a couple of weeks ago of the movie Kill the Messenger has brought new attention to Webb's work. With the movie in mind, Ryan Grimm has been talking to some of the principals lately, and here he is with some of the story. I should say that Webb's book Dark Alliance, a much expanded version of his original series of articles, has just been reissued by its original publisher, Seven Stories Press. Ryan Grimm. Welcome, Ryan. We've got Gary Webb back in the news again, many years after his death. Before we talk about him, though, I would like to just review some of the history of U.S. intelligence and drug dealing. It's a long history. It's certainly not something that began with crack in L.A. and the Gary Webb story, right? It goes back at least to World War II?
At least, sure. And the most most prominent case from back then involves Lucky Luciano, who was, basically controlled the heroin trade as much as somebody can control a trade. Because actually, I think referring to some of these things as cartels is misleading. They're much more diffuse than that. But yeah, Luciano was a giant heroin importer who ended up getting busted. He was in prison during World War II, and the government came to him and asked for his cooperation in the invasion of Sicily. He had plenty of contacts there, and aided the Allies in taking back Sicily. And as a result of that, was pardoned and immediately deported, where he quickly went into business, back into business. I'm sure he never left the business, even though he was in prison. And the CIA used him again then, or the government used him again then in 1948, during the really pivotal 1948 Italian elections, where it looked like the Communist Party was on the brink of taking over, and the mob basically went to war against the Communist Party and helped the American-backed government win. All this time, he continued trafficking heroin. He set up the distribution center out of Marseille, which became known as the French Connection. He had American backing there as well because they were battling, socialist labor unions there. And for decades, Luciano never got busted. More generally, when you're doing intelligence or war making, you're typically dealing with shady characters, whether that's the Hmong tribes over in Laos or whether it's the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who were trafficking drugs, or whether it's the Contras in Nicaragua. So it's not surprising that the dealing in this world, you'd often be working side by side with drug traffickers.
And of course, you mentioned another couple of instances of this. There was, of course, the heroin trade in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is, acknowledged. The CIA does not dispute that they were that a lot of their the people that they were working with were drug traffickers and were known at the time to be drug traffickers. Sometimes they look the other way because they feel like they can't do anything about it. Other times, they're thankful because it's a revenue source, and you want to be able to stand up your rebels or your government, whatever it may be. And so if they have a steady revenue source, then that's a useful thing. In particular, that's one of the allegations with the Contras.
Yeah, in Southeast Asia, they're using it to support covert activity.
I don't know how covert it was. They were, but yes, they were allied with tribes over there who were basically doing anti-communist work, and these tribes were heavily involved with heroin trafficking.
It's amazing how often the theme of fighting communists by allying with drug dealers and mafiosi keeps popping up in this story. Then, of course, the Afghanistan war has been one in which the heroin trade has figured prominently.
Oh, absolutely, and up until this day, the Times reported in the last couple of years that the government's policy was to go harder against poppy growers and drug traffickers in Afghanistan who were not allied with the U.S. coalition. There are warlords over there, well known to be involved in the drug business, who the U.S. has not arrested, even though they sit down in meetings with U.S. officials. So it's not as if they can't find these people and don't know that they're dealing drugs. It's that it takes a backseat.
I think Karzai's brother was one of the big dealers, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah, and that's the other thing about it. We're not talking about side figures here. Some of the most powerful figures in the Karzai governing coalition were drug running warlords. which nobody disputed.
And now moving on to the Gary Webb story. It was not news exactly when he broke it that the Contras were involved in the drug trade. I think there have been scattered reports earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the AP first started reporting on it practically in real time, which sparked some congressional inquiries, led by John Kerry, which was actually quite a diligent and impressive effort on his part. There was no obvious political upside that I could see for him to do that. He made a lot of enemies in the process, and he uncovered tons of links between drug running and the Contras, who were basically a wholly supported army working on behalf of the CIA, and he found numerous examples of CIA knowledge, full knowledge that this was happening, and no examples of the CIA alerting the DEA or anyone else who might do anything about this. So no, it was certainly that element of it was not new.
But then, what did Webb bring to the story?
So what he brought was he put it on the ground. He had two very specific Nicaraguans who were Contra fundraisers and well known drug traffickers. One was referred to by U.S. attorney out in California as the biggest drug trafficker in Nicaragua, and the other's nickname was the King of Drugs, which puts into an interesting light the later denials that the Contras or the CIA would have known that this person was, you know, where he got the funds that he was giving to the Contras. You know, his well-known nickname was the King of Drugs. So these two figures were part of a ring that supplied a man named Rick Ross. His nickname was Freeway Rick Ross. His name has since been usurped by the rapper Rick Ross. He was a legendary drug dealer in the 1980s who was among the first, if not the first, to build an empire out of crack cocaine. He eventually left L.A. and set up shop in St. Louis and had a number of other operations going in cities across the West and the Midwest. He was referred to by the government at various points as the Walmart of crack cocaine. You know, the LA Times did a profile of him in the early 90s saying that that he was basically the eye of the storm when it came to the crack cocaine epidemic. And so what Webb was able to do is connect these two Contra fundraisers as the principal suppliers of Rick Ross. And Rick Ross told Gary Webb, and has since told me and others, anybody who will ask him, that his business's growth was enabled by the prices and the consistency that he was able to get from these two Contra fundraisers. So what Webb did is take it from an abstract claim that the Contras were involved in drug running, or even a more specific claim, the ones that Kerry made, for instance, that this company operated out of this airfield and shipped drugs into the country. What he was able to show is where these drugs went, you know, a physical address in Los Angeles, and where they spread from there. And so you had the black community in Los Angeles first, and then elsewhere around the country, erupt when they found this out. So, you know, this was in 1996 he published it. So the reaction was, you know, you mean to tell me that the devastation of the black middle class, that the ruination of these neighborhoods, the mass incarceration of our youth was happening at the same time that the CIA's army, you know, was involved with shipping the drugs in. That just infuriated people, the injustice and the hypocrisy of it, and it was that reaction that then led to the counterreaction.
And that counter-reaction was remarkable. I mean, the Los Angeles Times and Washington Post went after Webb in a major way, right? So could you describe this campaign of the papers that were more powerful and more prestigious than the San Jose Mercury News?
Sure, yeah. The three big papers they saw the reaction in the black community, and in fact they cited the reaction of the black community in making their counterattack. The Post, the Washington Post, said out loud in its editorial that more shocking than Webb's claims was the reaction of the black community. Howard Kurtz told me in an interview, Washington Post columnist, former, I should say, that it was specifically the reaction of the black community that made him dig further into this. And the LA Times put, I forget the exact number, but well more than a dozen reporters onto what they called internally a Get Gary Webb team.
And to point out that they didn't put anything like those sorts of resources into investigating the sorts of things that Webb did, right? They sort of let that one fly past.
No, not only that. And one of the leaders of the LA Times team was Jesse Katz, who just something like 18 months earlier was the guy who had profiled Rick Ross and basically called him the biggest dealer since Al Capone. His lead has like seven cliches strung together to describe the size of Rick Ross's operation. And then 18 months later, when it turns out he was getting supplied by Contra fundraisers, they write a story that, this guy, there are a lot of dealers, and, there's cocaine's been coming into the country for a long time, and lots of people sling it. All of that is obviously true, but all of a sudden, this guy, Rick Ross, who the LA Times had called the biggest dealer practically ever, becomes like some nobody once it's clear that he was involved with the Contras. The Post had its slightly different mentality. I talked to Doug Farah, who was the Central American correspondent for the Post. He, the morning that Webb's story broke, he said there was an election in Managua, so he was able, by chance, he said, to round up all of the different figures that he needed to talk to, and was able to confirm a bunch of what Webb had reported, and even to advance some of it. And one of the pieces that he later advanced in the Post, like they buried it in the paper, but it was published, was that there was in fact this meeting between these two dealers who were Contra fundraisers and Enrique Bermudez, who is a CIA agent who was in charge of logistics for the Contras, who told them to go ahead, that they should feel free to run drugs, and that the ends justify the means. That was his quote to them. So Farah dug all this up and filed what he told me was a story that he was extremely proud of. He sent it up to Washington, and Walter Pincus basically got it spiked. It still ran in a smaller version, buried in the paper, but what ran was Walter Pincus's front page piece saying that these claims are two things. One, obvious, and two, not to be believed. They take this strange kind of dual approach to them, but Walter Pincus is, he covers the CIA, and he's very close with it, and he was able to win the internal battle there over how the Post would cover this.
Well, he didn't really cover the CIA. He even had an intelligence history of some sort, didn't he?
Yeah, he had gone on a couple of he had been involved with a CIA front group, which people kind of speculated was a bit of a tryout, in which he later has said it probably was a tryout for whether or not he would join the agency full time. And he says that he decided not to and went into journalism instead. So I interviewed him about that as well. But he does in fact have some actual professional intelligence connections.
I'm speaking with Ryan Grimm, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post and author of the book This Is Your Country on Drugs, which came out in 2009 but has enjoyed a new lease on life because of the material in it on Gary Webb and the Contra drug trade. And what was the thrust of the establishment's debunking of Webb?
Well, you had a couple different approaches. One was to pick apart, some of the language. Let's say he said that the Contras helped establish the quote first pipeline, into the LA ghetto. They would say, well, this is ridiculous. There was coke coming in before this. So, if you're Webb, you could quibble over the definition of pipeline if you wanted to. If you wanted to defend that, and the agency itself and a lot of the media really went livid over the use of the phrase CIA's army. The media said that makes him basically a not credible person to be saying something like the CIA's army, because it is an obvious truth, but it's one of those truths that you're not supposed to put in print that bluntly. It was an army that was built, financed, trained, armed, and led by the U.S. But sure, it was made up of Nicaraguans. So they objected to the CIA's army phrasing, and more broadly, they argued, look, the crack epidemic would have happened, regardless here. It's ridiculous to say that these two Nicaraguans, even if they were giving some small amount of money to the Contras, were responsible for the entire crack epidemic. And so what they would do is they would inflate the claims that he made and then puncture them.
But in fact, he was fundamentally correct, right?
Yes. I mean, now obviously two Nicaraguans are not responsible for the entire crack epidemic, but he never said that they were. There were some implications made that where somebody could leap to that conclusion, and certainly a lot of readers did jump to that conclusion. But there were plenty of people that believed that to be true before Gary Webb ever ran his story. So he was kind of crucified for what many people already believed or took from his piece. But yes, the basic facts are still not in dispute, that Enrique Bermudez, a top Contra official and a CIA agent, authorized these two Contra fundraisers to raise money for the Contras by trafficking drugs. And it is indisputable, it is occasionally disputed by people, but it's indisputable that Rick Ross was a huge figure in the LA drug world. And the other irony here is that when in a normal conversation about the 1980s, people are so quick to assign blame to drug dealers like Rick Ross. Like, how could you have done this to your community? How dare you? What kind of a moral monster are you? But the second that there's some indication that he might be involved with Contras, now all of a sudden, actually, this was going to happen anyway. He didn't have anything to do with this. It's quite remarkable how quickly he goes. Somebody like Rick Ross goes from history's greatest monster to somebody who deserves no blame for anything at all.
And then under this attack, the Mercury News withdrew the story, and the editor wrote a retraction of sorts that actually won him an award.
He's now a professor or something down at LSU. I'd be interested. I've called him. I haven't heard back from him. I'd be interested to hear what his take is at this point. He actually never withdrew the piece. What he did is he wrote a column saying that mistakes were made at all levels, and that that readers took from the piece things that the piece never said, and they take responsibility for not writing it tighter for people to misread it. That's basically what he wrote. And Gary Webb told him in the final meeting before he ran this, he said, if you run this column, it's going to be read as a retraction. And there's some more irony in there, because he's apologizing for writing something that people misreading a story in a column that he can be pretty sure people are going to misread. So Webb said, if you write this, everybody's going to say San Jose Mercury News. Even they backed off this piece, and they're going to discredit the entire story. I don't know what Seppo said to that, but he ran the column anyway, and that is precisely what happened. And to this day, people will say that the San Jose Mercury News retracted or withdrew the piece, which isn't actually true. But that was the effect that it had, and he did indeed win some award for it.
And, of course, Webb was ruined and eventually committed suicide several years later.
Yeah, they moved him out to some dustbin bureau, Cupertino, I think it was.
Well, that is Apple headquarters, though.
I guess he could have found stuff to look into there. So they moved him there. He quit. Got some settlement under arbitration with them. Before he committed suicide, he worked for an alt weekly, continuing to do investigative work, and also worked for a state Senate committee doing investigations. And then I was told that he was so destitute by the end he couldn't afford his medication. He had a lifelong battle with depression, and then he committed suicide 2004.
Now we've got this big feature film. I know you haven't seen it yet, but do you think this is going to lead to some sort of rehabilitation of Webb's reputation?
I think it has already. I think that among, there are people that have always supported Webb, and then there are people who have always detested him, and I think that camp won't be moved by the movie. But I think in the popular imagination, he and his work will be redeemed. I don't think it's actually that controversial of an idea anymore to suggest that the CIA was involved with some drug traffickers in the 1980s. So in that sense, Webb has been redeemed here.
And the establishment reaction to the Webb stories sounds kind of like an earlier version of what we experienced with Snowden recently. There's a kind of template for these responses, which is, it's outrageous and irresponsible of you to say these things. We knew them all already, but besides, they're not true.
Right. Howard Kurtz is for me one of the better distillations of this because he's not particularly sophisticated, and so you get the blunter stuff out of him. I don't know if he's working fast or what it is, but you just get it pretty raw from him. He had one line in particular that said something like, there were allegations that the Contras were involved with drug trafficking in the 1980s, and the Reagan administration even acknowledged as much, but it was never clear whether the CIA was aware of it. Which you have to wonder who's editing this guy. Wait a minute. So you're telling me that the Reagan administration knew that the Contras were running drugs, but somehow the CIA did not. Wait a minute. Okay, so back up again. You're telling me that the Reagan administration knew that the Contras were running drugs. Where was this reported? And he would say, he would occasionally say, it was reported at the time. But if you go back and look, it was barely reported at the time. The AP story that went out was not exactly put on the paper's front pages. And when John Kerry's committee put out its report, the Post barely covered it. So they go, yes, like you said, they like to have it all kinds of different ways.
And they don't have to be consistent. That's what hegemony means for you.
Not even in the same sentence.
That was Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post and author of This Is Your Country on Drugs. The HuffPo ran an updated excerpt from the book the other day on the Gary Webb affair. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you.
baby, dress in white. Hey, baby, won't you stay the night? Cocaine all around my brain. Come on, baby, dress in red. Hey, baby, won't you come to bed? Cocaine all around my brain. Hey, baby, won't you please come quickly? This old cocaine's making me sick. Cocaine all around my brain.
That was some of Cocaine Blues in an early home recording by Nick Drake. Next up is Jake Blumgart. Blumgart is a contributing writer to the webzine Next City, which covers urban affairs. He has a piece that was posted earlier this week on the site, which is at Next City, one word, nextcity.org, The Housing Crisis We Don't Talk About, which is a close-up look at Chester, a small impoverished town near Philadelphia. We're used to talking about gentrification and displacement when we talk about the urban housing crisis, but there are many mini-Detroits like Chester around the country where the problem is deep poverty and a rotten housing stock. Here's Jake Blumgart to tell the story. Welcome, Jake. First of all, just give us the idea of what Next City is.
It's a kind of urban policy and politics web magazine based here in Philadelphia. They have a weekly feature called Forefront that's usually 3,000 to 5,000 words and kind of allows a writer to go in depth on any number of topics. I've written about the fate of Atlantic City before all the casinos started closing, and also about Wilmington. It basically allowed me to do a lot of profiles of small cities in the region that don't necessarily get a lot of press attention otherwise, because, you know, they're kind of small regional hubs. And in the case of this article about Chester, it's an extremely depressed area. I don't know if I can get anybody else to pay me to look into it. So that's basically what Next City is. They've got daily content. They've got this Forefront series, and then they also sponsor a number of events both in Philly and all over the country. So, yeah, that's the basic gist.
Moving on to your piece, as the title suggests, we're used to talking a lot about the urban problem of gentrification and displacement, but then a place like Chester is another story entirely, right?
Right. It's basically a city that most Americans, you know, wouldn't even know existed. You drive by on the highway, the train runs through it, and, you know, you'll basically see a few dilapidated row houses and some kind of boarded up shops, and then it's gone. And it's, you know, just a deeply impoverished place. Over a third of the population lives under the poverty line. Unemployment rate is almost 18%, and that doesn't even take into account all the people who aren't even in the labor force. I mean, there's nothing there, basically. It's when you get off of the train station downtown, it's incredibly grim. I mean, when you walk up the Avenue of the States toward the City Hall, and part of that even is boarded up, you know, you have these old bank buildings that are just empty. You have old hardware stores empty. There's basically nothing but water ice stands and the occasional bodega. And other than that, yeah, there's just not a lot of business, although there are a lot of people kind of just hanging out.
There are many such places in the United States, of course, but like many of these other places, Chester has seen better days. What was its heyday? What happened since?
It was an industrial powerhouse. It was one of these. There are a number of small cities in Philly's orbit that were kind of these worker towns back in the day. So Camden is a much more famous example, being right across the river from Philadelphia, whereas Chester is about 20 miles down the river. So the Pugh family came in at the end of the 19th century, bought up a bunch of land on the waterfront, and opened up a refinery in Marcus Hook, which is right next door, basically.
Did you say Pugh family, like the Pugh Trusts?
Yes, and also the Sun Shipyards. So those were two big employers, and then kind of following in their wake, there was a Ford factory, Scott Paper. There's this poster you'll see, like a kind of you know, ironic posts are, you'll see in a lot of like coffee house bathrooms, it says something along the lines of like, is your bathroom breeding Bolsheviks?
Oh yeah. Yes. Yes. That's in the nation's bathroom too.
Yeah. And if you look in the bottom, at the bottom of that advertisement, that's a Scott Paper advertisement and it's made in Chester, Pennsylvania. So there were a lot of factories, a lot of factory jobs. And of course, during World War II, it really boomed, and the Sun Shipyard was cranking out ships constantly there, and there was a huge demand for labor. A lot of African Americans moved up from the South. I found a dissertation in the University of Pennsylvania archives about African American laborers at Sun Ships. It said it was the largest employer of African Americans in the U.S. during World War II. You know, so you basically got all these people up to Chester, and then after the war, capital started to flee the city, and the white population also started to flee the city. There was a really strong Republican political machine at the time that enforced segregation in a pretty rigid fashion. So it was very hard for African Americans to move out when the job center started to move elsewhere. And it basically resulted in this situation where you have this vast majority African American city that's deeply impoverished, has almost no jobs. When you look at like 85% of the people who are employed in Chester actually work outside of Chester, where because, you know, all the kind of working class jobs are out in the malls and things like that. They're not in the city anymore. Yeah, it's just incredibly grim. The tax base is utterly destroyed. The services are scant. There's one building inspector for the entire city. And as I go into in my article, there's the need for housing oversight is pretty extreme.
Yeah, this sounds like, you know, Detroit on a small scale, right?
Right, that's exactly what it is.
So, despite this long story of downward mobility, there's still, what, about 30, 35,000 people living in this town?
Yep, yep, yeah. There's still a pretty substantial number of people, and I talked to a lot of folks for this story, both people who I was connected with via lawyers or public housing officials who I was speaking with, and I was just kind of walking around the city interviewing people. None of them, no one is happy about the context in Chester. I mean, you talk to anybody there, I mean, the first thing they talk about is the violence. It's very violent. I believe there have been so far this year 24 murders in a city of, yeah, like a little under 34,000 people. But yeah, I mean, it's just everything. The school system is a wreck. A lot of that's mostly controlled by charter companies now. And yeah, as I said, there's just no jobs and the housing stock is mostly in a pretty miserable state.
Yeah, your article opens with the tale of a guy who rents what is a literally uninhabitable house for, what, $450 a month. And it's basically his problem.
Yep.
Tell us his tale of real estate woe.
Donnie Evans, I mean, he's a real character. Having spent some time with him, he's kind of one of these guys who seems to, like, know everybody, and he's got some mental health issues, and he basically was working for this landlord in Chester, from what I understand, an under-the-table type deal where he would kind of, like, you know, do various odd jobs for the guy. And so when Donnie had a fight with his girlfriend and he needed somewhere to live, this guy basically offered him a house for $450 a month and under the assumption that Donnie would clean it out. And so Donnie agreed, gave him the first month's rent. He gets there, and he signs this lease, which is this kind of handwritten thing, very dubious looking. And so Donnie gets there, and there's so it turned out there's no certificate of occupancy for the house, so it can't legally be rented. And because there's no certificate of occupancy, there's no running water, no electricity. You basically can't get any of the utilities turned on. But it's also winter, and as anyone in the Northeast or Midwest, for that matter, will recall, last winter was really intense. Snowing all the time, really cold. So Donnie basically made do. I mean, he stopped sending the guy money, but the house is just unbelievable. I mean, he had to drag a gas heater into his bedroom, which is just, you know, hugely dangerous. And there are like scorch marks on the walls. But, you know, he didn't have anywhere else to go. But the guy ended up taking him to court to get the house back. And the judge split the difference between them. So he gave Donnie some of his rent back, but also charged him court fees. So it was just an unbelievable situation. And now he, the last time we talked with him, he, you know, was homeless and didn't have anywhere to live.
I'm speaking with Jake Blumgart, a contributing writer for the webzine Next City, where his article, The Housing Crisis We Don't Talk About, appeared. Speaking of court cases, you review some of the stats on the landlord-tenant disputes in the area, and somehow the landlords almost always win.
Yes. When I was talking to some of the lawyers who handle housing cases in Chester, they kind of told me that anecdotally, that the landlords always win. And so we looked into the court records, which is a little tricky. It's easiest to see the cases where the landlords are bringing the tenants to court. And yeah, overwhelmingly, something like of the hundreds of cases I reviewed over a 3-month stretch, the cases were decided for the tenants only 3 times. Now there were a few instances where something appears to have been worked out or the case was dismissed, but the vast, vast majority of the time, the landlords won.
Now, there is a public housing authority in the city. Public housing, of course, is very out of fashion now, although it has a history of actually delivering people reasonably decent housing. But what's the role of the Chester Housing Authority in all this?
So the Chester Housing Authority is a really interesting case because it used to be that Republican political machine I mentioned used to be in control of it. It was just kind of run as a total patronage mill. It was staffed with people who had no idea what they were doing, and it was one of the worst housing authorities in the country. They had these 4 public housing complexes, and they were just run very, very poorly. And especially as Chester became more and more African American and poorer, and so the kind of needs of the populations sheltered in those units rose, the inadequacy of a housing authority as a patronage mill really became very evident. But, yeah, I mean, and there are just horrific stories from the 80s about raw sewage and open-air drug markets and all this kind of thing in public housing complexes. So in the early 90s, some tenants sued, and HUD came in and took the housing authority over, but the tenants sued again a few years later because they felt that progress wasn't being made fast enough. So a judge came in and took the authority over. And since then, it's actually been doing really, really well from what I can tell. Again, all the public housing tenants who I spoke with were, you know, pretty happy with their housing. And now there was a lot of Hope 6 type projects after the judge took over. That was kind of the height of Hope 6, which was basically a program where HUD basically incentivized housing authorities to knock down some of their old stock and replace it with fewer new units. There wasn't a one-for-one replacement policy in place, basically. So the housing authority ended up losing about 400 units. But I do have to say the new units are genuinely much nicer. I talked to a couple tenants who've lived there their entire lives through both iterations of their projects, and they are very thrilled with the new units, which are, I mean, honestly, some of the, you know, I was walking around Chester some, and, you know, when I was in those projects, it was, you know, you feel like very safe. There's a lot of people, you know, walking their dogs and whatnot outside. It's just a very different environment from a lot of other neighborhoods in the city where the housing stock is just so dilapidated and crumbling. So, and then on top of that, they also control the Section 8 vouchers, which kind of allows them to exert some power over landlords to force some changes that otherwise the landlords kind of don't have the wherewithal or the wherewithal or the desire to really, you know, make repairs. I should also say there are definitely some good landlords in Chester. I spoke with one woman who was used to be a dance therapist and got in and became a landlord and ended up actually moving to Chester to be closer to her investments and has done a lot of work organizing kind of the good landlords in the city. But from what I can tell, that, you know, seems to be the exception, not the rule.
And I didn't hear any mention of the state. I imagine, especially under your crazy-ass governor now, it has not been performing a very constructive role.
No. I didn't go a ton into Pennsylvania's role in this article. I did. There were some programs that basically provided money for the repair and maintenance of older housing in Pennsylvania's older cities. But those programs were cut by, I believe, 2/3 under Governor Corbett. So, you know, that's a relatively small part of all this, but it's still, yes, I mean, he hasn't done anything to help. The one interesting thing I should say is that the Republican who's the head of the state Senate, Dominic Pileggi, is actually from Chester and still lives in Chester, which is, again, I mean, there are some, like, old neighborhoods that are, you know, where the rich people used to live, including where the boss of the political machine used to live, which is now a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. But I mean, it's just pretty impressive that that arguably the most powerful Republican in the state actually still his primary home is still in this city.
That's odd. And you mentioned in passing also that the schools have been mostly charterized.
Yeah. I didn't really have the space to go into that in this article, but Dan Denver, who you've had on your program, has talked about that failed experiment in some of his articles. It's very much, you know, basically one of these systems where it was a grossly underperforming school district for, you know, all the reasons you might think, you know, very high poverty, very high need students, not very much money coming in from local property taxes. And basically, they tried to remedy this by charterizing everything. And as far as I know, it hasn't really worked.
So, I mean, the moral of all this is that, you know, the federal government, it can be a good influence, and that public housing actually also can be a good thing as well.
Yes, definitely. One of the things that's impressive about the Chester Housing Authority is that they've, particularly over the last few years, have still managed to maintain, you know, relatively high levels of service, despite the fact that they're still getting their funding cut. They got hammered by the sequester. They had to lay a lot of people off. It's definitely taking them longer to do repairs now than it used to. But yeah, I mean, in a context like this, where you just have a very poor population, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to leave the vast majority of people to be cared for by kind of private sector landlords, most of whom, you know, because it's cheaper to buy, you know, a new car or than it is to buy, you know, a house in Chester. So you got a lot of people who are like, oh, I'll come in, I'll buy a couple of houses, make some money, you know, and like not really understanding the full weight of what they're taking on. And so you can't expect, you know, the kind of private sector to adequately care for tens of thousands of people in this way. Now, clearly also the public sector didn't do a great job of it when the political machine was in charge of the housing authority. But now that it's actually a well-functioning bureaucracy, it's doing great work. Yeah, and it really is providing good housing for the few people who can get in. Now, the one thing I didn't mention is that the waiting lists for public housing and for Section 8 are years and years long. I mean, it's very hard to get into those units. And there's no sign that it's going to get any easier in the near future.
That was Jake Blumgart, a contributing writer to the webzine Next City. His piece, The Housing Crisis We Don't Talk About, is behind a paywall at nextcity.org, but the price tag isn't that high. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Time to Waste It by Brian Eno and Carl Hyde from their album High Life, released early this past summer. Till next week, bye. Thank you.
have to say.